It's Friday, May 28th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, a Belarusian blogger plucked from the skies and placed under arrest, increased calls by authoritarian governments to control the web, and media companies take heat for dismissing journalists and analysts. Our Suzanne Nossel dissects the big free speech stories this week. Then, The Russian Key, a new novel by acclaimed human rights activist Jerry Leiber. She talks about the book and her incredible career. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on The Pen Pod. And now we turn to Tough Questions, our weekly segment where we put difficult questions about free speech to PEN America CEO Suzanne Nossel. She joins me now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
So, Suzanne, I want to start with Belarus. The country's strongman president, Alexander Lukashenko, forced a commercial airliner to land on Sunday so that his security forces could arrest a blogger. I'm wondering, what does this incident say about not only what's happening in Belarus, but the threat that this kind of act poses to journalists, dissidents, and writers worldwide?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we have been documenting over the last several years a rising trend of what we think of as the long arm of authoritarianism. So repressive governments reaching across their borders to apprehend dissidents. We've seen examples of this, the Beijing government arresting a bookseller on vacation in Thailand, obviously the case of Jamal Khashoggi lured into a Saudi diplomatic installation in Istanbul and then butchered to death, Iran menacing exiles who are here in the United States who have experienced threats and needed protection for fear that they may be targeted, another Iranian journalist who was living in France and kind of lured into Iraq where he was kidnapped and brought back to Iran and tried and hung at the end of last year. So this sort of disturbing trend of reaching across borders to nab people that regimes see as a threat. And this most recent attack on Roman Protasevich is just a new escalation of that tactic and something, you know, I don't think, you know, maybe a Hollywood scriptwriter would have thought of, you know, sort of a fake bomb threat to force a plane down while it was over Belarusian airspace in order to apprehend Mr. Protasevich and his girlfriend, who are both now being held in custody. But, you know, it's a state-sponsored hijacking. I think that's what the CEO of Ryanair called it, and just sort of a new demonstration of the lengths to which governments are willing to go and the kind of spectacles that they're prepared to create. And, it, you know, it's obviously about silencing one journalist and now, you know, holding him in custody and he faces legal jeopardy and could be in for a long prison sentence, but it also sends a message to everybody else who is in exile, who thought that they successfully fled to freedom, you know, in the West and had perhaps started a new life, that, you know, they're never really safe. And I think part of it also is the rise of digital and social media. It used to be if you went into exile, you had to forfeit your influence and your audience and your voice in the issues that you were advocating for back home. And now, you know, that's not so much the case. You can still connect and be influential online. And so governments have recognized that, and they're taking these drastic steps to try to muzzle people through new tactics.
Yeah, an extraordinary, extraordinary story. You know, speaking of the global digital context, the New York Times reported this week that Russia's government is continuing to urge platforms like Google, Twitter, and Facebook to remove content the Russian government says is illegal or restore content that had been blocked. You know, it seems like there's a showdown here looming between countries that want to assert their so-called digital sovereignty within their borders and this idea of an open and free internet. What's your take?
Yeah, look, it's not a new tension. This is something we've sort of known about for a long time, that there's an inherent you know, sort of force field involving governments that want to, you know, and have taken often drastic steps to control the flow of information within their borders, you know, that license publications and shut them down if they don't like them, that governments that jail journalists and writers. So we talk about that all the time. It's sort of like, well, how does that square with an internet that is global, where content is, you know, moving across the world, and it's not subject to these national boundaries that have traditionally enabled the repression of speech? And so there are a host of tactics that different governments have undertaken, many of which we have documented, you know, reporting on internet and social media censorship in China and the Great Firewall, also in Iran. In Russia, it's been kind of interesting in that the internet has been sort of a relatively freer zone in some ways than in other authoritarian countries. They sort of haven't tried to assert the level of aggressive digital sovereignty that, for example, China and Iran have. And what we see, though, in recent months is a kind of stepping up in that direction. And, you know, the way they're doing it is through insistence that the Western-based social media companies, Google, Facebook, et cetera, Twitter, adhere to their demands in terms of the removal of content, or even maintaining, holding up content that the Russian government, Moscow, believes should be available. So content from, for example, government-controlled media outlets like RT. And this all kind of came to a head after the January protests in support of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, and the online social media platforms were sort of used to mobilize those protests and actions and for people to coordinate and kind of fan the flames of dissent. And now they're clamping down. And, you know, for the social media companies, look, they've always said we adhere to national law in the jurisdictions where we operate. And, you know, in fairness, they sort of have to, because if they don't, they will be shut down. But the problem arises where that national law is in contravention with international human rights law precepts and or the company's own professed commitments to, for example, freedom of expression. And so that's what we're seeing here, where so the Russian government is pushing the bounds of its law and becoming more insistent about controlling online content in ways that certainly contravene international law, but are legally justified within a Russian legal framework, or at least arguably so. And so for the companies, you know, they're in the dilemma lies. You know, do they resist this under the potential penalty of being kicked out of the country, you know, which itself admittedly is sort of a loss to free expression. And, you know, if you talk to people in these countries, they will say that even sort of within the constraints of government censorship, it's still better to have access to Twitter or Facebook or Google. And so the specter of their being kicked out of the country entirely is not an appealing one, you know, obviously not from a commercial perspective, but also from a expressive perspective. And yet, you know, the further the Russian government goes, the more these platforms become, you know, kind of a shadow version of a government-controlled media outlet where certain perspectives are banned and others are elevated and amplified. And, you know, that becomes profoundly distorting. So it poses some real dilemmas. And this is kind of a clear escalation of a fight that's been brewing for a long time.
Well, Suzanne, just to finish up here, I want to come to the U.S. context, where, you know, there's still a bit of a controversy brewing around two journalistic personnel decisions. On the one hand, CNN made the decision quietly last weekend to drop analyst and former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum after offensive comments he made about Native Americans. At the same time, the Associated Press laid off a young reporter for ostensibly violating the company's social media rules. Where do you strike the line between, yes, we want people's speech to be protected, even occasionally offensive speech, but also that journalists have sort of a higher responsibility when it comes to ensuring credibility?
Yeah, well, it's complicated. I'll take each of the two cases. The AP case, you know, we had in 2017 when we did our first report on disinformation, which is called Faking the News, we looked at this issue of how the credibility of mainstream news outlets was being systematically eroded. And a lot of that had to do with Donald Trump and his attacks on the press, but also a growing sense among the American public that the media is partisan, that it has an agenda, that it's not, you know, really in the business of straight and credible reportage. And so in the context of that, we came to the view that when it comes to social media, there is an appropriate role for a news outlet in saying to journalists that, you know, whether it's taking a position on a contentious issue or delivering a political opinion or, you know, in other ways, kind of straying from the expected role of a news reporter, that it's fair and even necessary to put some limits on that, because the tweets were being used to cast aspersions, not just on an individual journalist, but on entire media outlets. And they're being kind of fanned as grounds to discredit the serious journalism as fake news. And we thought that was a quite a dangerous thing. And I think the Associated Press, you know, is a particularly kind of striking example, because if there's anything that remains in our media ecosystem that, you know, is kind of a real nonpartisan, across the board, straight up news source that you can turn to for sort of a just the facts, ma'am, account, it's the Associated Press. And so I understand why they have the social media policy. You know, I can't evaluate exactly what happened in this instant, and they haven't revealed the full facts, you know, but the story is sort of upsetting because it's a young woman who was recently hired, who, you know, came under attack from people who knew of her record as essentially a campaigner for Palestinian rights on her college campus. And, you know, she had made some very problematic comments, including using dehumanizing anti-Semitic language about a Jewish individual. And so this whole controversy stirred up. And then, you know, right in the wake of that, the AP terminated her, saying she had violated their social media policy since becoming a journalist on the staff. And, you know, it just sort of raises the question, did they do this under pressure? You know, was the violation of social media policy really just a proxy for their discomfort with things that were exposed that she had said and positions she had taken before she started the job? And kind of the whole thing just had this feeling of a very harsh and summary reprisal against someone, and for murky reasons, and, you know, in the context of a public pressure campaign. And, you know, that brings me to the Rick Santorum case, where, you know, it was a public pressure campaign of a very different sort. He had made this dismissive remark, you know, essentially negating Native American contributions to American culture, you know, something that, you know, at a personal level, I would say is false and demeaning and denigrating and highly problematic. And in the wake of that, there was a campaign by Native American organizations to try to get him disciplined or removed from the network. And, you know, the problem with that from our perspective is we just don't like the idea of public campaigns to pressure for reprisals against speech, and particularly isolated incidents and acts of speech. I mean, you could disagree with a lot of things that Rick Santorum has said over the years, but it seemed as if this campaign was really directed at the one isolated comment. And sort of when a media organization gives in to that pressure, the pressure can be intense, and they often do give in. But the worry is it just sort of reinforces this idea that they ought to be policing speech, and that, you know, if someone comes to them and makes a stink about something someone said, you know, that may lead on a direct path to discipline or termination. And I think, you know, for news commentators, for journalists, and for all of us, you know, to live in a world where we know that if someone objects to what we say, you know, they can stomp on their feet and get our employers to fire us, you know, it is constricting. And I think just narrowing of the space, the available space for conversation and discussion and the exchange of views. And so we've called on CNN to articulate, you know, what are their criteria for these commentators? We've seen a lot of them be fired in recent years, you know, on bases that are hard to understand. And, you know, there's just this worrying sense that if you stray over the line, you know, whether you're a Rick Santorum, who has a lot of power and influence as a former senator, or, you know, perhaps in other instances, commentators of color, you know, for whom CNN was maybe, you know, their only or very important platform in their career, you know, also being terminated summarily in the wake of isolated comments. And so it's a trend line that we don't like, and we hope CNN will offer some clarification and a more principled approach going forward.
Well, Suzanne, as always, appreciate you walking us through these complex issues. Suzanne is CEO of PEN America. She's also author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All, which lays out a lot of these principles. Thanks, as always, for being here, Suzanne.
Thank you.
A new novel about Cold War intrigue from a leader in the human rights movement. The Russian Key is the latest from Jerry Leiber, a founder of Human Rights Watch and a former board member of PEN America. The book is out now, and Jerry Leiber joins me now. Welcome to the PEN Pod, Jerry.
Glad to be here.
So, Jerry, congratulations on the book. I'm wondering what made you decide, after years of writing nonfiction and human rights exposés, to take on novel writing?
Well, actually, during all those years at Human Rights Watch, people kept telling me that I should write a spy novel. The reason they said that was because of the many undercover trips that I was making to the Soviet Union and the communist countries of Eastern Europe. They were undercover trips because there was no way that I, as the director of a human rights organization, would get an entry visa to enter any of those countries, and therefore I had to disguise who I was. I would apply for a visa, giving my, the purpose of my trip as a tourist and my occupation as housewife. I developed a secret code that I used in my address book to indicate the names and addresses of the dissidents that I was planning to meet. And in order to keep my notes inconspicuous when I left the country, I would had developed a way of writing in a script so tiny that I couldn't read it myself without a magnifying glass. When I was there, I never used phones or taxis because both were bugged. I just showed up at the doors of people and took my cues from them as to where and how we would meet and talk. But despite all of those precautions, I had a number of run-ins with the secret police. I was interrogated and searched. I had several brief arrests. I was told leaving Romania that I would not be welcome back. And in Czechoslovakia, I was once summarily expelled from the country.
Wow.
So, I wrote about all this in articles and ultimately in a memoir called The Courage of Strangers, Coming of Age with the Human Rights Movement. And Kurt Vonnegut blurbed the book, and in doing so, he coined the phrase compassionate espionage to describe my work. So finally, yes, when I retired and finally had some time on my hands, I thought, well, why not write a novel? And why not about spies? And so we have The Russian Key.
I mean, I'm curious. I mean, it's obviously your own story is so fascinating. You'd already put it into a memoir. What were some of the things that you were able to do in the fiction form that you maybe weren't able to do in your memoir or in other writings?
Well, actually, the plot, the idea for the book, was inspired by a real-life event that happened in my life many decades before the human rights movement even began. It was in 1954. I was a graduate student at the Russian Institute at Columbia University, and I and three other students were the first Americans to be granted visas to enter the Soviet Union after Stalin's death. It was really an unprecedented trip. There were no Americans had been allowed in that country for many, many years, except maybe for the small U.S. embassy staff and the literally handful of journalists who were American journalists who were still there. And they were, of course, kept under constant surveillance. So our trip, of course, was also highly monitored. But the Soviets wanted to show us their best image. They took us to museums of the revolution and to young pioneer camps and model collective farms. And our main disappointment, frustration, was that we were unable to meet with ordinary Russians, to talk to them, to see how they lived, what their lives were like, what they were thinking. I did have a brief conversation with a Russian student at Moscow University during a guided tour. He seemed interested in me and learning about me, but there was no possibility for any follow-up. And then, when I was leaving the country, I did something really stupid, really reckless. When the customs officials told me that I couldn't bring undeveloped film out of the country, I tried to smuggle it out hidden in my suitcase, and I thought I'd gotten away with it. I was in the plane, the engines were revving up, then suddenly they stopped the plane, they opened the doors, they came in.
Wow.
Asked for my suitcase, opened it, took the film, and then sent me on my way. Now, they could have arrested me. I had literally broken the law, but fortunately, they didn't. So, thinking back on that experience, I was a very young girl at the time. I took that trip as a starting point for my novel, and I turned it into fiction. My protagonist is Kate Landau. She's a naive, romantic college girl who finds herself in Moscow in 1954, where she meets Max, a handsome Russian student, and they have an unforgettable romantic tryst in a Moscow park. After which he gives her a small golden key as a keepsake. 10 years later, then trying to protect Max, Kate ends up in a Soviet jail. 10 years later, Kate is working for the CIA. She's assigned to investigate a KGB officer who is masquerading as a Soviet diplomat at the United Nations. And that KGB officer is Max. They meet again and start a passionate affair. And that is the start of my book. I'm not going to tell you any more.
Don't.
Where the action takes off.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of incredible, I think, now to read both memoir, fiction, nonfiction, about the Cold War era. And yet, you know, I think if this book had come out maybe, say, 20 years ago, it would be read very differently. I think you've been in this field for decades. Are you seeing, as you were putting this book together, as you were recounting your own experiences, creating fabricated ones, are you seeing some of that same level of crackdown, that same level of authoritarianism, that same level of tension that there was during that period of the height of the Cold War? Are we seeing something similar happening in the human rights landscape right now?
The answer, I think, would be yes and no. The period I'm writing about in the book is history now, and I think it will be very informative to young people who didn't live through it, as I did. They'll learn a lot about what the Soviet Union was like about the Gulag, about the Soviet repression, about what totalitarian can really be. Whereas today, Russia is very different than it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s, really, right up until the time of Gorbachev. It was a very backward place, isolated, without any internet, without any technology, because it was technology which really brought about all the difference ultimately. But before the mid-1980s, they tried to keep technology out of the country, out of the hands of people. They saw it as a threat to their total rule, and they were right, of course. Ultimately, I think technology was one of the major factors in the fall of the Soviet Union. But so that, you know, back in those days, and it was really up until the mid-1980s, things like government fax machines were kept under lock and key, and ordinary people had no access to any kind of information. They didn't know what was going on in the outside world, and more important, they didn't know what was going on in their own country. Today, we have protests like those surrounding the case of Alexei Navalny. That would have been unheard of back then. But there is a true civil society in the Soviet Union today. And once that was allowed to develop, there's really no turning back, which is not to say that Russia today doesn't have a brutal regime.
Right.
The excesses are out in the open. You see them. Putin is shameless, actually. He's punishing his enemies, and not only in his own country, but abroad as well. But he's wielding a big stick, but he hasn't been able to conceal the fact that the economy there is weak, that there is vast corruption in the country, and popular dissent on a very large scale. And hopefully that these things ultimately may bring him down.
I guess, reflecting on that in the world, where do you see then the human rights movement itself in responding to the sort of changing nature of global authoritarianism? How do you think the movement right now is sort of, where is it strongest? Where is it able to address some of these concerns?
Well, I think the human rights movement right now is facing more problems than ever. And at the same time, it's more necessary than it's ever been. But, we have serious human rights problems here in the United States. And we've lost what we probably never should have had, the moral force to be of our own morality that we thought the world should emulate. I think we're having to face up to serious problems in our own country, and we have to deal with them before we can be taken seriously as a beacon of freedom for the rest of the world. But at least we have a president now who's well-versed in human rights concerns. I used to testify for Human Rights Watch before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Joe Biden was the man in the chair.
Right.
He knows those issues very well and was very sympathetic to them. But now he's president, and as president, he has to balance those issues with other concerns like trade relations and military alliances and diplomacy in general. And that often leads our country into sort of unsavory alliances with other countries and other characters. My hope is that Biden will speak out about human rights abuses as he sees them in other countries and use penalties such as sanctions wherever possible. But more important, in situations where it's not possible for practical reasons, that he will speak out anyway and explain candidly to the American people or to the world why it's diplomatically or whatever impractical to actually punish those people. I'm thinking specifically of Saudi Arabia right now and the Khashoggi event. But that's something that I think no administration since Jimmy Carter has done in this country. Instead of speaking out and saying, well, we have other reasons for not exacting penalties at this point, they just ignored the human rights abuses altogether and allowed human rights concerns to drop from the agenda completely.
Yeah, it's time for those to come back. Well, let me ask you finally, now that you've your pen's down on your book, you're obviously busy, I'm sure, with book tour. But what are you reading right now?
Well, I try to keep up with good contemporary fiction. That's my interest. I'm reading, at the moment, I'm reading Colin McCann's book, A Paragon. Mm-hmm. Very unusual and very interesting book indeed. But While I was writing The Russian Key, I read tons of nonfiction about Cold War espionage, which I found really fascinating. I learned a lot myself. And I also read a lot of suspense thrillers, you know, the kind of book that you pick up and end up reading in 2 or 3 days because you just keep turning the pages and you're not able to put it down. I like to think that's what my novel, The Russian Key, is like. It was certainly my intention when I was writing it, and I hope I've succeeded.
Absolutely. I can say for sure I got to read it already. Well, Jeri Leyper is one of the founders of Human Rights Watch. She's a former PEN America board member, and her new novel is The Russian Key. Thanks, Jeri, for being here.
Thank you.
And that's our episode for Friday, May 28th. We're taking a break next week, but we'll be back with a new episode on June 11th. You can listen to all our episodes at PEN.org. Follow us at PEN America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for PEN America. This is the PEN Pod. See you soon.